Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Banter on the Parkway. I am your host, Brian, from BannersOnTheParkway.com. We are joined, as always, by Brad. Brad, you're still not bad. How long does it take a meniscus to heal?
If you rest it and ice it and do all the stuff that doctors tell you to, probably not that long. I'm trying to see if you just continue living your normal life, and like running and riding your bike and coaching soccer and all that stuff, if maybe that's a good step in the rehabilitation process. So far, it has not been. Also, if I'm being honest, it's kind of nice to like have sunlight and not be locked in a closet while I'm doing this.
Okay. How much does coaching soccer involve your meniscus? Because when I coached soccer, all it was me yelling the word run a lot, and I can do that sitting down.
I usually, in a high school game, I walk about 3 miles a game, and in a club game, I'm somewhere around 2. I'm a bit of a pacer on the sideline. I've never gone full Shaka Smart and actually gotten on the field and like tried to interfere, but I definitely move up and down the sideline a lot. Think Jose Mourinho in the Porto years.
Okay. Interesting. Braden, I mean, you played center back when you played soccer. Did you move 3 miles a game?
Depends on how much I was getting beat over the top, and I wasn't very good, so yeah. Usually it was about 6 or 7 miles, all at a dead sprint because I was getting cooked. But shout out to Brad for getting his cardio in.
You're like, oh, crap. Braden, he's like, somebody should stop that guy. Oh, no. So Xavier was in action this past week. And let's be honest, these were two games that I think it wasn't so much that I wanted Xavier to win as I just couldn't handle Xavier losing. It was Xavier 91, DePaul 58, on the home floor. This was a game where DePaul had it within 4 at halftime. At one point in the first half, I mean, it looked like DePaul had all of the momentum and was actually going to make a game of this. And then Quincy Oliveri reached his final form in the second half, dropped 28 points after halftime, and Xavier pulled away and won very comfortably. I mean, I don't – we're past the point where we can learn anything from beating DePaul. But, Brad, I mean, there's a moment that's going to stand out from this game, I think, for everybody. Can you just walk us through that Brad Colbert 3? I think that is probably, beyond Quincy cooking DePaul again, going to be what Xavier fans remember about this one, if they remember it at all.
Yeah. I think that, you know, I wrote after this game that this season, we all still hope it ends in the NCAA tournament. It's very likely, most likely, that it doesn't. But I think college basketball always gives you moments that make you happy, that remind you why you watch and everything. And I think Colbert's 3 was one of those. One thing to remember is that a guy who's a walk-on, at a preferred walk-on at a D1, is a really, really good basketball player. There's not a lot of people that can throw a shoulder fake, take a quick gather step, and then knock down a three-pointer from 23 feet that are just walking around out there. And, you know, Xavier's thickest walk-on did that. I've got a soft spot in my heart for walk-ons. I walked on to the college team that I played for and then appeared in all of 10 games and made no three-pointers. That, you know, Joel was a walk-on. You do all the practicing, all the bus riding, all the cramming for classes, especially if you know you're not going to, like, turn basketball into any sort of career. You actually do have to pay attention in class and do your homework and everything. You do all the sprints, and then you sit and watch a lot of games from really close. And Brad Colbert could play at a D2 and start and be a star, but he just keeps working to get his D1 moment. So when he knocked down that three, for one, I thought Connor Onion on the call had been excellent the whole game, and he correctly read the mood for how much that shot was going to mean to the Cintas and to Xavier fans, and called it like Colbert was shooting to send X to the Final Four, which was a great job on his part. And then the crowd went nuts, but I think the key in these things is always the teammates. You can always tell how much they want these guys to make a shot. And, you know, Colbert was slapping fives with everybody. He high-fives Trey Green, and he's jumping up and down. And then somebody, I think it's Nemo or Djokovic, I'm trying to remember without watching the clip again here, has to remind him, we do have to go play defense now. And he points Colbert one way, and Colbert runs to the wrong guy. And then he gets, like, a gentle hand on his shoulder again. And he's like, your guy's actually is over there. And the crowd is still roaring. Then they start chanting MVP. It was a great moment. When he hit that, my whole family was in the front room. And the four of us that were watching came up off the couch. God love my 11-year-old. Basketball is not her thing. But everybody jumped up. What a cool moment. Even if this season ends the way we all think it's probably going to end, that's going to be something I think we all remember for a long time. And good on that kid for taking his chance.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's a mystery, but most people who watch college basketball, you know, their dream was to play D1, obviously. It's a pipe dream for most of us. And so it's really cool when you see that happen for somebody just through their hard work. You know, a guy who I think Xavier fans remember fondly was Eric Stenger, who walked on and ended up being a significant contributor to a team that went to the NCAA tournament. You know, he played in the first four, and he made that dream come true. So it's really cool to watch that happen for a guy who just has shown up, worked really hard, and finally got his moment. You know, and I got a couple of texts from people who don't watch basketball but live in the Cincinnati area, and they were like, hey, some Xavier kid got me free chicken nuggets at Chick-fil-A. So I was sending that clip to a bunch of people the next day and being like, go get your free nugs and thank Brad Colbert. Colbert, while you're there, because he provided this for you. You know, I acted like he'd hit the first nine threes as well. But anyway, so that took us to Saturday, where Xavier was a participant in Georgetown roulette. And Georgetown led this game by as many as 15. It was 40-25 with about 3 minutes left or 4 minutes left in the first half. Xavier trailed by 12 at halftime, and then second half, Des Claude took over. Braden, I mean, Des has, I think, at times frustrated this year. But I mean, how nice was it to see him do what he does well and, just be able to bring Xavier back to win this game so that this season didn't drop to the levels of losing to Georgetown or DePaul.
I'm going to be honest. You cut out for a second there, so I'm going to imagine the question was, how awesome was Des Claude this game? And really awesome. That's the answer. The second half, yeah, it was full Des Claude takeover mode. He, I guess, decided that jump shots weren't his thing. And that was about 25-ish games later than the rest of the world decided jump shots weren't his thing. But good on him for figuring it out. You know, it's a period of self-discovery when you're in college. And I think Des has learned a lesson. But, man, he just attacked and attacked and attacked. Georgetown's not a good defensive team or a good offensive team. they're just bad at basketball. But between two games with Xavier, they have looked like the Golden State Warriors because they just can't miss sometimes. But in that second half, Dez did not settle for anything. One of my favorite plays he had was when he came off a screen. You could see him look and realize, oh my gosh, I'm wide open at the top of the key. And he just didn't care, drove it straight in at the center anyway and laid it in. He had another one where he drove, I think expected contact and ended up with his back to the rim and just kind of flipped it up and it went in. I mean, he was on fire. It's the second highest scoring output in the Big East season behind Quincy Oliveri's 43 points. And I mean, he could basically do no wrong in that second half. Everything ran through him. He was making good decisions. And I mean, even when he wasn't scoring, he was diming people up. He hit McKnight for a big three. He kept the offense moving. It's not like it went stagnant and he was just trying to hit 40, even though I really wanted to see him hit 40. But I mean, he was untouchable. Especially after the first half, Georgetown, I mean, I believe they shot, what was it, 63% from three in the first half or something like that. They hit eight or nine threes in the first half and then came back down to earth. And Dez was just able to grab this game by the neck, and he didn't let go. And we ended up walking away on the back of his 36 and our 46th free throw attempts, which as I was walking it, I thought, we are getting to the line a lot, and then the little graphic popped up, and I was like, oh, I didn't realize it was that much. But I also thought Kachi Enze, he's been getting more run recently. I thought in the DePaul game, he tried really hard, and there wasn't a whole lot of output you could really put your finger on. This game, he came out and he was ready to play. He was leading the team in scoring, I believe, at the end of the first half, at least for most of the first half. Ended 5 of 5 from the floor, 3 of 4 from the line, tipped in 6 rebounds, only 1 turnover and 2 steals. I thought he looked really good. He looked really solid. You know, Georgetown's not a great team, but I gotta imagine that's a big confidence builder for him. He's looked very aggressive, and in this game, he looked a little more comfortable once he was getting around the rim. I mean, he was just rolling hard, getting the dump offs, making one move if he had to, and then going up hard and strong. And I think he's looked really good. It's something that X is going to need if they're going to make that deep run in the Big East tournament, which they need at this point.
I think you talk about confidence. I think probably part of the reason, and this goes back to why I think Sean Miller is such a good coach, is like you said, Kachi was really bad against DePaul. Like, the man just could not hold on to the basketball. And when he did, he then usually was shooting like a 6 or 7 foot shot from 2 feet away. Like, he was going up strong against DePaul. It had to be tempting, I think, for Miller to run back a guy who is more comfortable or doesn't look like he's trying to throw the basketball through the backboard, but instead he just started Kachi again at Georgetown and gave him 28 minutes, partly because Abu Usman couldn't keep his hands to himself. But I think for a freshman who hasn't played a lot, that vote of confidence from the coach to run him back out there and say, hey, just keep working, you're doing what I like, probably helps him quite a bit. You know, and then there he is throwing down a huge dunk near the end of the game to kind of seal it, and he went from 0 for 4 from the floor to 5 of 5 and realized that, you know, throwing the basketball so hard against the backboard that you hope it deflates and then falls in is not something that is going to pay off frequently. So a little more touch, 3 of 4 from the line. They might have found something there. I mean, his offensive rating in – it's short sample, but is 108.9. I mean, he knows what he does, and then just goes and does that. That's all. That man just stays right in his lane and does what he can there.
Yeah, I thought he was really impressive in that game, especially with the foul trouble that Usman was in and the fact that, I mean, Georgetown really, the only thing they do well on offense is get to the offensive glass. Although against Xavier, they also shoot like 90% from three. So I thought it was really, really funny watching the telecast of this game with like 8 minutes left coming out of the next last media timeout. Like they flashed up a graphic about how long it'd been since Georgetown won a game in March. And it cut to like Ed Cooley hugging Jaden Epps and being like, yeah, we did it, buddy. And I was like, Georgetown sucks and they constantly melt down and throw games away. So I don't know why we're bringing out the Mission Accomplished banner. It was as misguided as Jeff Goodman's tweet after they beat DePaul, where he was like, twice as many games as there's some, I don't know, whatever stupid thing Jeff Goodman said after Georgetown beat DePaul to make it seem like Georgetown's improving, when actually they just are paying their head coach a lot more money for essentially the same results. I don't think the results are markedly better than they had been under Patrick Ewing, but anyway, I thought it was super funny that they were like, we finally did it. And then, no, they had not. Xavier went on a 12-2 run, during which Ed Cooley, I mean, he froze. He realized he's not built for this. He was like, uh-oh, what do I do now? Somebody should do something. And it wasn't him. Anyway, but he is rich as excrement, guys. I'll tell you what. It's winning at life. So we are in March. You know, we got tournament basketball from today until Selection Sunday. There are tournament games going on throughout all the conferences in the country. And then, of course, you know, you get that two-day break, that deep breath, and then we plunge right back in with the first weekend. So, I mean – We're in it now. I know last night Florida Gulf Coast was playing Queens, who's not eligible for the tournament this year. And Isaiah Thompson went off for Florida Gulf Coast, and the rest of the team went home. I don't know what was going on there, but unfortunately, there will be no return of Dunk City this year. It's really incredible this time of year to just the amount of basketball there is to be watched. So looking around at the bubble, it's really kind of taken shape here, and it's the weakest bubble I think we've seen. No, I'm kidding. It's always the weakest bubble. These teams are on the bubble because they're not very good. And people, I think, somehow forget that from year to year, and they're like, wow, these teams aren't very good. Well, yeah. That's why they're not locks. But, I mean, we had a bold prediction at the start of the year by Brad, of all people, that Florida Gulf Coast – or not Florida Gulf Coast, Florida Atlantic would be a bubble team. And we're sitting here on March 5th on Bart Torvik's tourney cast. They're sitting at a 49.2% chance of an at-large bid. That is as bubbly as you get. So, you know, a rare W for Brad. We're going to take a moment of silence and just let him bask in this strangest of feats. He has said something that actually turned out to be correct.
I mean, this is a little bit of overkill. It's not like I'm one of those ball knowers on Twitter who, you know, completely, I do know the game a little bit here. Yeah, Florida Atlantic, I think, got really lucky during their run last year. They're not as good this year, and boy, have they put out some bad losses. They lost to the aforementioned Florida Gulf Coast, Bryant, Charlotte, UAB, and South Florida. So, yeah, they're in trouble. They got North Texas and Memphis to finish up their regular season, lose either of those, and they probably need the automatic bid. Which is not going to keep everyone from fawning all over them if they get back in the tournament again.
There you go, folks. Seth Greenberg with less hair has spoken.
Oh,
the deep burn.
I think Wake Forest has a really, really interesting resume or team sheet or whatever we're calling them now. They're really good in the predictives. They're 26th in BPI, 21st in KenPom. They're good in Torvik. They're 31st in the net, and they're 57th in strength of record, and 51st in the KPI. They are 6-11. Math is hard. 6-11 in the top two quads. And every time it looks like they're about to salt away a bid, then they go and do something dumb. I think they'll be an interesting one, depending on how their season finishes. Colorado, this is without getting into the Big East, but of course, our Mountain West, New Mexico has really hurt themselves. And the Mountain West just keeps sliding down to the point where they're somehow, if they play this thing right, the Dayton games could be just an extension of the Mountain West tournament. Colorado State, Nevada, New Mexico are all crammed in, kind of around the bubble, and Boise State sliding that way. If that happens, Bean, I'm assuming we're going to meet at Dayton, and just be like Rob Lowe when he wore the hat that said NFL, just get hats that say Mountain West and just go cheer for great lunatic basketball.
Oh, heck yeah. Yeah. I love me some Mountain West. I'm with you there. They could legitimately, those four, I think, out of the Mountain West, San Diego State, Boise State are really the only ones that have locked up a bid. I think New Mexico's close, but they are capable of beating a top 20 team and also losing to a sub 200 team. Because they have no level of consistency. I don't know what their deal is. They're a fun team to watch for that reason, and I love everything about them. Yeah, I mean, Wake Forest, like you said, they got an interesting resume. 6-11 in the top two quads is or 7-11. Wow, you do suck at math. The nice way of saying they're 1-6 in Q1, and I mean, their one Q1 win kind of, you know, has a black mark on it after their students, you know, basically committed felony assault on Kyle Filipowski, which he somehow recovered from. But, you know, thank the Lord for that one. What was up?
I said thoughts and prayers. Thoughts and prayers to Kyle Filipowski as he overcomes that, you know, bump.
Yeah, I mean, it's a miracle. I thought I was going to have to be sending out a tweet that said, rest in power, King. But, you know, here we are, and he's made a miraculous recovery. So, good on him. I will talk a little bit of the Big East on the bubble right now. Seton Hall, St. John's, Villanova are all projected as 11 seeds. The one Big East team listed on Bracket Matrix as other at-larges is Providence. They're projected as an 11 seed. So we could theoretically have a four Mountain West. It'll basically be Mountain West versus Big East challenge, except we're going to be doing it in the postseason. It would not surprise me at all if you see, you know, Villanova and Seton Hall playing against New Mexico and Colorado State or whatever it is. Or Nevada, I guess, would be more likely. But, yeah, the Big East has a few real bubbly teams right now. Villanova's been hot, but I don't know how much I trust them to really lock up this resume. Plus, if they don't beat somebody good the rest of the way, they've got so many bad losses at this point. I don't know if they'll have enough to hold on. Seton Hall, they've got a really solid top end of their resume, but their non-con wasn't that great. St. John's is St. John's. You do not know what you're going to get from them. But they have had some good wins recently. And then Providence lost to Villanova last week, which has kind of slid them down a little bit. If they can get into it, I think that's kind of a miracle based on, you know, just how their season's gone with who they've lost. But Providence is still in there with a chance. Butler has basically shot themselves out of contention, and so has Xavier. Both of them, though, probably the way for them is to get to the Big East final and hope that they get that at-large bid. But they're both on very thin ice at this point. So that's the Big East bubble. But like Brian said, every year it's a historically weak bubble. And I must admit, when he was saying that, I looked at the other at-larges where it lists it on the Bracket Matrix, and I was like, man, how are these teams here? They suck. Like, Iowa's got 9. They're on 9 brackets. I'm like, how? Iowa's terrible. Memphis is still on one, so shout out Penny Hardaway and Javon Quinterly.
So,
the smoke. He has to get fired after this year, right?
You'd imagine so, right? I mean,
why you're shaking your head vehemently that he will not be fired?
Heavens, no. You're in the AAC. Who are you going to go get?
I mean, maybe somebody who doesn't lose to Rice and UAB and Tulane right in a row.
Go with a legacy hire. Derrick Rose.
Pat Chambers.
Yeah, I don't think Pat Chambers is probably who they're looking for in Memphis, Tennessee. I'm just saying he has goodwill with the community, and I don't know that Memphis – like, I think Memphis is a really good brand, but they have gotten really kind of left holding the bag with all the conference realignment. I don't know who you go get because you're in a conference that, I mean – nobody wants to be in. So, I think the most likely NBA player from our childhood who's coaching his alma mater to get fired this offseason is by far Juwan Howard because they're not even close. And he keeps punching people.
Allegedly. He is decompensating right in front of our faces. I always liked the Fab Five, but you feel like at some point in time, Derrick Rose and Chris Webber are going to have an intervention with Juwan Howard when he's just like sitting out in a cabin in the woods and he's grown like kind of a patchy beard and added 30 pounds. And they're like, dude, you need to talk to a therapist.
Yeah. And then they'll probably call Jalen Rose in too.
Yeah.
I said Derrick Rose. Yeah. I think Jalen probably would be a better chance since they actually know each other.
I think he probably knows Derrick Rose, right? Like, I mean, he's aware of him at the very least. No, you know who you go get because he already spent so much time at the university? DeAndre Williams. He's also about the age of Penny Hardaway now. I think that dude was like 30 last year when they got – they celebrated his 30th birthday and then got knocked out by the Owls. So, love me some DeAndre.
Both 1 year removed from playing college basketball and old enough to be most of those guys' dad.
Yeah, like I mean, you know how they bring in like a seasoned veteran on like a baseball team or something, you know, to show the young guys how to conduct themselves like professionals. That's DeAndre Williams right there.
I'm assuming
anyway.
He's right now.
Yeah, I don't think Penny's in danger of getting fired. But what do I know? Here's what's interesting is, I love this. You can just go to the Tourneycast feature on Torvik and see what the heck is going on. Villanova right now has an 88% chance of, making the tournament at all, which is a pretty good chance. You look at the rest of the Big East, St. John's has a 96% chance. And then, of course, you got the three teams at the top who are all essentially locks at this point. But Villanova, according to the 10,000 simulations from Torvik, has a better chance of being a 4 seed than being an 11 seed, which is absurd to me. But they are a 4 seed. Let me get the – they're a 4 seed 5.4% of the time they make it, and an 11 seed 4.9% of the time. So they have a better chance, according to these simulations, of getting a protected seed than they do going to Dayton, even though, I mean, they're far from a sure thing right now. And they have that big game against Seton Hall coming up this weekend. So Villanova continues to just – I can't look away. It's just they confound me. And I think they confound computers because they're like, I don't know what the heck to do with these guys. Maybe they're awesome. Maybe they're terrible. Maybe they don't even make the tournament. I really don't know. That's AI for you, folks. We need the human element. Anyway – In other news, I guess, the crowd goes mild as UMass has decided to move from the Atlantic 10 to the MAC. Brad, when was the last time, because I don't think it was during Braden's lifetime, that this would have been big news?
We were talking about this a little bit before we started recording, and I said 20 years ago, and it turns out that's not even right. You said maybe 30, maybe 25 years ago in the late 90s. This would have been big news. Is back when Bruiser Flint was there. I mean, UMass, they kind of were a brand for a little while. Marcus Camby, and that's where John Calipari started his cheating career. Braden, without looking, since you were born, how many times has UMass been in the tournament?
Well, I'm already looking, and I just based off of my base of knowledge, I know it's zero because I've never thought of them as good.
They made it in 2014. Yes, when you technically had been born. If you hadn't been born in 2014, your marriage right now would be very troubling. Derek Kellogg took them in 2014. And other than that, guys, they just have not been good to the point where when somebody said, you know, I was listening to the Ion Basketball guys and they talked about UMass switching conferences. I mean, it just, you're like, oh, okay. They're coming to the MAC now. Home of my second team. I don't really care. Akron is better than UMass, which is weird, but true. So UMass is moving, conference realignment. I guess we're probably supposed to care. I know they're chasing football money, but in a basketball sense, this doesn't move the needle very much at all.
No, I was thinking about the old A-10 days, and for me growing up, I remember, you know, X having some great shootouts against, you know, St. Joe's, Richmond, Temple, UD. Not once did I think about, I don't have like a memory of Xavier playing a great game against UMass. There's probably one that I just don't remember, but I never thought of UMass as like a legit team we had to be worried about or anything like that. So it's at least been, you know, 23 years since they've been relevant.
Yeah, that's because they've won one A-10 championship of any stripe since you were born. They were, well, and it wasn't an outright championship. In 2006, 2007, they were co-champions with Xavier of the A-10 regular season. They then lost in the first round of the A-10 tournament to St. Louis and went to the NIT. So, yeah, I guess that's news. Well, and it is, I mean, more conference realignment, but I think UMass probably thought that was a bigger splash than most anyone else did, because I can't imagine many A-10 people being like, oh, no, not UMass. we got a couple of questions from Twitter here. One's from Nick Ireland. With the possibility of getting the sixth seed in the Big East tournament still there, is there any shot of an at-large bid if Xavier beats Butler, Marquette, then goes to the Big East tournament and beats Creighton and Marquette before losing to UConn in the finals? So, I mean, this is, I think he laid out probably the only feasible road to a at-large bid that Xavier has remaining at this point. Brad, I mean, can you break down the numbers for this? Does that get Xavier a bid? Does that have them outside of Dayton? Can they still get a four seed like Villanova?
No, the four seed has long since passed. We have to remember X is now sitting on a Q4 loss as well. Delaware, thanks a lot, guys. Is now a Q4. So you go with what he said, that would make X 7-11 in Q1 and 5-2 in Q2. That'd be really good. At the tourney cast, like you were talking about over at Bart Torvik, is generally the best tool out there to see what could happen. So that would mean win against Butler, win against Marquette, and then win against Butler, win against Marquette, and then beat Creighton before losing to UConn. That, according to Bart Torvik, lands Xavier one of the last four byes, which means not playing in the play-in games in Dayton, and gives them a 78.6% chance of making the tournament. So I think if X wins until the Big East final, but does not win the Big East final, I think they're in. There is still that chance for an at-large bid. Anything short of that, though, even if they lose in the semifinals, is going to leave them on the outside looking in. So at this point in time, Xavier cannot afford to lose until the tournament final. And if they do somewhere in there, then they got to have the auto bid. That's basically what it comes down to. There is no way around it. That's it. But yeah, getting to the final should do it. So long as something really weird doesn't happen and we like beat Butler and then Georgetown or something, because they need to be good wins on the way to the final. Not just, they got to be good wins on the way to the final. That just is. And also, how did we lose to Delaware?
Braden was there and he is a jinx.
Yeah, sorry, I stepped into the building and Jalen Trent all of a sudden was just that guy. And no one, and I mean no one, could stop him. I did kind of like watching Sean Miller get progressively more angry on the sideline in person, because it felt more human than just watching it on television.
So, I mean, that scenario that he laid out is still only a 60% chance. Which, I mean, listen, we've been through Selection Sundays, where it was, 60% chance. They are stressful affairs. You know, if it's a 60% chance, I hope Xavier is in the first region that gets called, because I think there was one year they were the very last team announced. It was 2017. Where it was all the way down to the wire, and I'm probably still have too much stomach acid from that day. That scenario he laid out, Xavier is still very much dependent on chalk winning other conference tournaments. You know, if someone weird like San Francisco goes and wins the WCC, even making the Big East final might not be enough for Xavier. So, you know, my advice would be just win the Big East tournament is what I'm prescribing here. I think that's probably the safer route. Is just, you know, go to Madison Square Garden and just keep winning until there's no one left to beat. We have another question from Brad's son. He didn't get on Twitter to submit this, though. So, anyway,
He's not allowed to allow it.
Was that comeback proof that Xavier has a genuine shot of beating Marquette? So, Braden, I mean, Xavier can score 1.69 points per possession over one half against the 310th best defense in the country. Does that mean they can beat Marquette?
No. No, not even remotely. Georgetown's just awful at defense. Marquette's a top 20 defense. the whole thing against Georgetown hinged on Des Claude getting as hot as he's ever been since he's been in a Xavier uniform and being able to drive and do whatever he wanted with whoever was guarding him. And that was always a Georgetown player, and Georgetown players are on a terrible defensive team. Marquette's not going to be that way. Also, if Xavier spots Marquette a half of shooting 63% from three, we might as well just call the game then, because it's over. I'm sorry. I don't want to be Brad. I don't want to be a negative Nancy about this. But we just can't do that against Marquette. If they get that hot in the first half, the comeback would have to be insane, and Des Claude and Quincy would have to be hitting at the same time. Which it seems like all year we've had maybe a handful of games where both of those guys are hot. But no, to answer Brad's son, no. A comeback against Georgetown is just proof to me that Georgetown is a terrible team with a mediocre head coach, and they had no clue how to close that game out. Marquette is not a terrible team, and I think their coach is better than Ed Cooley. So they'll have some clue of how to stop Xavier.
Yeah, I think they got one of the best coaches in the nation, and I know you guys don't agree with that, but more to the point, Xavier is the best team in the nation in changing their offensive efficiency in the second half. No team in the nation has a better second half offensive efficiency compared to their first half than X does, and I guess that leaves you some room for hope if X is trailing against Marquette come halftime. But, yeah, if they're down 15 to Marquette at halftime, that's going to be shut the game off and go for a walk outside and remember that there are other things happening in the world than 20-year-olds playing basketball. Or what I'll actually do, sit on the couch getting progressively more angry.
I never said Shaka Smart was a bad coach. I just said I don't like him. Like, he's a fine coach. I just can't stand him.
I don't think you can doubt Shaka Smart's ability. He's basically like having a sixth man on the floor, mostly because he's a sixth man on the floor.
Yeah.
That is commitment to help side defense that you don't find in many players, let alone other coaches.
It's not help side. Very few coaches. Very few coaches have I seen where it's as if he walked onto the floor and physically guided the player to where he wanted him to be. But with Shaka, it's like that. Because I watched him do that. He grabbed a person and was like, go here, in the middle of a game. Anyway, I don't like Shaka Smart, but, that's my thing. So, we are on to Xavier, player of the week. Brad, I think there are two candidates here because Xavier twice was not doing as well in the first half as you think they should be against a terrible team, and then someone put Xavier on his back and carried them to victory. So were you more impressed with Quincy Oliveri carrying them to a victory against DePaul or Des Claude carrying them to victory against Georgetown?
I mean, this would be easier if one guy had, like, carried him to a victory over Villanova or something, but they both took turns beating on a punching bag. I went with Des Claude mostly because I thought that his other game was slightly better. Quincy's game against Georgetown was weird. 0-4 inside the arc, 2-8 behind it, 10-15 from the line. Just a bizarre way to score 16 points, but more to focus on Des. He went full takeover mode against a team that I guess is a little bit more of a legitimate basketball team. I don't think you can go wrong with either. They both put up awesome performances to watch.
Yeah. Oh okay. Right. Braden, I mean, do you agree? Did you go off the board? Did you go with Kachi?
I wanted to go with Kachi really bad. However, his 44-0 rating he put up against DePaul is a little hard to ignore. I thought he hustled his butt off, though. Now, I also went with Dez. He shot two threes on the week, and across two games, he put up a combined 47 points without making any threes. I think that's good. I think that's a good thing. Didn't waste a lot of possessions shooting jumpers, and I mean that Georgetown game. He knew it was him. He got the ball, and every time he just drove it until he couldn't drive it anymore, and then he would lay it up and in or get fouled, and then he shot 10 of 13 from the line against them. All of that usage with only two turnovers, great performance, great game. Yeah, I think he just had the best all-around week.
Okay, interestingly enough, the guy with the best O rating, there was a player on Xavier who posted O ratings of 155 and 132 this week, who we have not mentioned. So I'm going to mention him. That's Davion McKnight. Because while the other two guards, were going takeover mode, I think he did a lot of the, less pretty facilitating work, especially against DePaul. He had 8 assists and no turnovers. Scored 13 points on fairly efficient shooting. And then against Georgetown, he did turn the ball over 3 times to 3 assists, but he had 18 and he shot 2 of 3 from deep on a night when Xavier hit 4 total threes and Quincy was 2 of 8. So I think I've talked myself into it being Davion McKnight. I think, across the two games, yeah, there were two guys who went takeover mode, but I think he, played with a lot of steady consistency. The other thing is Davion, logged 70 minutes this week. The Georgetown game, he never came out of. The dude's just a workhorse, and, I think, he does not get the appreciation he should from a larger audience. Every game, somebody's like, wow, can you believe this guy is leading the Big East in assist-to-turnover ratio and is 4th in the country? And if you watch him, yes, it's easy to believe that, but I don't think most people probably give him the credit he deserves. So I've gone with Davion. I've surprised myself. I'm giving it to him. So that is it for us this week. Xavier is back in action. They go to a barn because for some reason you're allowed to just host basketball games in a barn, to play Butler on Wednesday night and then host Marquette for Senior Day on Saturday. So we'll be back with you guys next week to look back at those two and look ahead at what Xavier needs to do in the Big East tournament. Thank you guys so much for listening. We'll be right back.